this is Saturday Morning Live. We're here every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. This is Radio Regent, and we now go to Amandla via African Perspectives. Up next.
CHRY 105.5 FM. This is Amandla and African Perspective, your source for news and views from the African continent. As I mentioned before the break in our introduction, we're going to be continuing our conversation today on South Sudan. And we'll be speaking to Machar, who was born in South Sudan, has been living in Canada for over a decade, and he's the chairperson of the South Sudanese community here in the GTA. Hello, Machar.
Hello, ma'am.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Last week we were having a conversation with Gerald Horn on the kind of historical context of the conflict in South Sudan. He was a mediator between Sudan and South Sudan in the 80s. And now we wanted to continue that conversation today, and especially around the South Sudanese diaspora here in Canada, which, of course, you're very in tuned with. So I'm going to start off by asking you just to give us a bit of context in terms of the violence of the past month in South Sudan. And if you could, if there is any, you know, kind of role or what the diaspora is thinking in terms of what's going on in South Sudan.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity. In terms of the context of what is going on in South Sudan at the moment, a lot of it has to do with the state building in South Sudan. And by state building, I guess I include the ability of the government to mobilize the public around certain public interest issues, in a state of allowing people to have loyalties, that multiple loyalties to different centers of power. So South Sudan became independent in 2011. That was in July 2011. In January 2011, it voted to separate it from Sudan. And of course, it has been at war. So Sudan has been at war from 1955, just before it got independent from Britain in 1956. And the whole cause of that war in 1955 was how to structure the government and how to avoid marginalization. So that was topic 72, and it broke out again in 83. And the war that broke out in 83 ended in 2005 with a peace agreement called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. That Comprehensive Peace Agreement was the basis of separation, was the basis of referendum in January 2011. And the referendum was the basis of separation in July 2011. Now, after they got it independent, in July 2011, the president, Salva Kiir, has focused mostly on maintaining peace. Because during the war, there has been various rebellions, fighting for different reasons and loyal to different leadership or even different ethnicities. And not everyone was fighting the Khartoum government at the time. Some were fighting the Khartoum government, South Sudan was fighting within itself and all that. So the focus of President Kiir after independence was to maintain peace, make sure that there's no rebellion. But of course, there was still rebellion. So that focus on making sure that there is peace kind of overtook other initiatives, including mobilizing the public around loyalty to the state and service to the public. And so those who were accommodated on the basis of having taken up arms kind of concentrated on making sure that certain sectors within the military are loyal to them, not to the state. And also some of these centers of power in the independent South Sudan also focused on accumulating wealth for themselves. So there was massive corruption. There was a lot of, you know, armed, not malicious, but armed citizens. And, you know, they're protecting who or they're protecting what. And so because all these forces were not loyal to the president, not the president, so they were not loyal to the state, they were always loyal to whoever was the leader at that time. And most of the time, that person also happened to be from that ethnic group. And so that pattern, you know, continued. The president himself veered away from what the war has always been about, which was fighting to avoid marginalization and fighting to give citizenship an opportunity to better themselves. So the president failed in institutionalizing democratic structures that would allow everyone to compete fairly for political positions. And of course, when there was a challenge, so before the challenge, actually what happened is that the president has been reshuffling his cabinet on, you know, I think he has reshuffled it 3 or 4 times, but the last major one was a wholesale dismissal of the cabinet, and including the vice president. The vice president at that time was Riek Machar. Riek Machar was one of the people that had rebelled against the SPLM, the movement, during the liberation struggle. He was accommodated. He was allowed back in 2002, and he was allowed back as a vice president. And when Dr. John, the leader of the movement, died in 2005, Salva Kiir, who was the vice president, or the first vice president of Dr. John, became the president, and Riek automatically also became the vice president of Salva Kiir. And around before the sacking of the wholesale sacking of the cabinet in July, that included the sacking of the vice president, the vice president declared his intention to dethrone the president. And he actually wanted to do it democratically. So he said he was going to contest for the seat of the chairmanship of the party, and the candidate, and the chair of the party would automatically be the candidate of the for the presidency. Now, President Kiir decided that he was not going to, maybe in a public debate, but basically what he did was, because of that challenge that Dr. Machar raised against him, he, you know, he was very unwelcoming of that. And because he has not built a national structure that would allow people to, you know, fairly compete for public offices, he went about trying to stifle this opposition through, you know, undemocratic means. And this included, you know, ensuring that the... So basically, he said he had sacked the whole... that he has dismissed the whole... party. So the party, the SPLM party structure, they said he had dismissed them, he had dismissed all the people who were in charge of various positions. And then he went about that, he is President Kiir in this case. So President Kiir went about trying to pass the documents of the governing documents of the party. That process, so the process of deciding how to pass those documents, I think it's where the whole thing erupted. But it has been building up through the dismissal of the cabinet, through the declaration of Machar, of Dr. Machar, to contest the presidency. And so around December 14th, there was a meeting of the National Liberation Council, which is the legislative body of the SPLM. And the SPLM is the Sudan People Liberation Movement. And so when they met, they discussed the documents, and some of those documents had some other provisions that did not please many people. On December 6th, the group that was within the SPLM, the group that was opposed to Salva Kiir, decided to hold a press conference to basically indict the government on its failure. And this group was part of the government, or largely part of the government, in, you know, at different stages during prior to 2013. So when they held a press conference, they indicted the government on its failures, on corruption, on, you know, undemocratic processes about through which various people came to power, and those included the dismissal of certain elected governors. It included the decision the president has made about the reshuffle in the cabinet, and it included the failure really to engage the international, the diplomatic efforts of South Sudan, and the failure to build to kind of finish the provisions of comprehensive peace agreement, including the border negotiations and oil and all those other things. Mm-hmm. So basically, anyway, when it erupted, what happened is that on the 14th, there was a meeting, and that meeting of the SPLM, the legislative body of the SPLM, passed those documents, or wanted to pass those documents. And the group that had been against the president in the party decided to withdraw because they felt that this was not a fair process, and so if it is not a fair process, then why stick around? They left, and so when they left on the night of the 15th of December 15th, there was an incident that is now hardly contested whether it was a coup or not. But so according to the president, there was a coup, and those who attempted the coup were led by Dr. Machar and the group that was opposed to the president. The version of the group is that this was not a coup, that Dr. Machar was fleeing for his life, and this was a shooting within the presidential guard. And so Vice President, or the former Vice President, Dr. Machar, fled, and 2 days later he said he was leading the rebellion against the government. So South Sudan, having been in war from 55 up to 72 and from 83 to 2005, is back to war now. And their whole thing is really around the contest of power and nothing more, in my opinion.
And that's important. In your opinion, it is a contest of power. How is the South Sudanese diaspora receiving this latest situation in the new country? So even the diaspora itself is fresh in terms of having an official South Sudanese identity. Of course, that identity is not new in itself. But what is the scene around the diaspora, around this conflict, and what kind of mobilizing is the diaspora under mobilizing in terms of the conflict?
The diaspora is really a mirror image of what is going on in South Sudan now. Majority of the people in diaspora are not interested in war. They want peace. And peace, basically, for a lot of people, means that there should be no fighting. But when that fighting ceases, then the question becomes, how do we address, all the things that led to war? So the democratization of the country, of the party, and also how do we address, those who have lost their life through this war? So those are the issues. Now, when you look at justice, according to the prevailing opinions that I see within the diaspora, is that when you want to do justice, you're going to do it against those who have taken up arms and those who are armed. And those who are within the government did not perform their national duty. They basically targeted certain people they thought loyal to the government. Now, when you want to focus on justice, in that case, the group that is armed will never lay up arms because they don't want to, to be punished. But if you want to follow up with peace, then, of course, you just cover up whatever brought about the whole explosion. And so covering up, basically, to some people, is a basis. Is a basis for another war in a few years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, right? Unless, of course, if that peace is agreed on the basis that a new rebuilding will be done. So, within South Sudanese diaspora, the majority opinion is that peace and peace, no more war. But of course, there are people like in South Sudan who are loyal to certain people. So they're loyal to either President Kiir, and so if you're loyal to President Kiir, you always say this was a coup, and you want X and Y punished, or you want X and Y, removed from the state. And in this case, X and Y for most people is Dr. Machar, and some people who are currently detained. But for other people loyal to Dr. Machar, their position is that President Kiir has killed some people as a head of state. He was responsible for the state forces killing, targeting certain groups during that night of December 15th and 16th. And so President Kiir should not be a president anymore. Some of these people also say that Dr. Machar was fighting for democratization. And so, right now he should be given the opportunity, or he should, he has the legitimate right to fight. Other people say he was fleeing for his life. So some of the prevailing opinions, but of course the reality is that Dr. Machar has taken up arms against the state, and so if he was fleeing for his life, he had the option of going outside the state. If he also was fighting for democratization, he could have stayed and allowed himself to be detained like some of those people in the prison right now. Even if there is a legitimate fear that he might not have leave, you know, people's sacrifice their life for the freedom that is now in South Sudan, including himself, Dr. Machar. He took up arms against the Khartoum regime, and that process of taking up arms against the state in Sudan was sacrificed. So if he was fighting for democratization, he should have, you know, stayed like those people. At least that's my opinion. He should have stayed like those people that stayed. Mm-hmm. And if he was going to be possibly killed, that is the whole, you know, freedom includes, you know, kind of committing yourself to to the process, to fighting for freedom, including death. And, you know, even, you know, Mandela said that. And if need be, this is the cause I'm prepared to die for, right? Yeah. So at the end of the day, I think personally that Dr. Machar, acknowledging that he's leading the rebellion against the state and acknowledging that he is fighting a president that was elected, is not the way to answer the government. The fear for his life is legitimate, and, you know, the failures of the president have been accounted and, you know, expounded on in several forums. But at the end of the day, you know, the way to write it is not to kill more citizens than you're going to leave. And then the conflict took the ethnic dimension, because Dr. Machar, nobody was loyal to him except people from his ethnic group. And this is not even everybody from his ethnic group. It's people that he was their patron, people that he employed, people that he, you know, basically fed on state finances. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So South Sudan diaspora basically is, you know, there are people loyal to Machar, people loyal to President Kiir, mm-hmm. and those two extremes usually forget what the realities are, what the facts are. Mm-hmm. But majority basically are interested in peace, mm-hmm. because civilians are the causes of are the reason that everybody fought for in South Sudan, and they are supposed to be the people benefiting from peace,
mm-hmm.
and that includes, you know, absence of war, at least. And so that is what, that absence of war is what the recent events in Juba have taken away from the civilian population of South Sudan.
And currently, as we speak, the peace talks are ongoing in Addis, and they're not really moving in terms of reaching a peace agreement. The mediation committee has apparently spoken with Machar and is hoping to speak with Salva Kiir tomorrow in terms of trying to kind of reach a peace agreement, since the talks have, you know, kind of failed. And I'm wondering what the role of the diaspora is in these peace talks. I know in Somalia, for example, the diaspora plays a pretty big role in terms of, you know, obviously the government, but also a different kind of development and peace talks. The diaspora, the Somali diaspora, has a seat at the table, and we talked about this on the show with Abdi Darshi, for example. I'm wondering, in the model of the South Sudanese peace talks, what is the role of the diaspora? Do they have an official seat at the table? And if not, what does the peace talks look like in the diaspora?
The diaspora, the South Sudanese diaspora, has no official seat at the table. When peace returned to South Sudan in 2005, a lot of people moved back to South Sudan in different capacities. When independence was, when South Sudan gained independence in 2011, some more people moved there. And so a lot of these people who moved from the diaspora, although they are not members of the diaspora anymore, were really part of the diaspora, and they have been involved in the government, and they were, you know, some of them were, you know, employees of the vice president, the former vice president, and some of them are employees of the president, some of them are just in the state institutions. So those probably are people who, you know, even though they are not members of the diaspora, really have influence on what is going on in South Sudan. And the negotiation going on right now at Addis Ababa, you know, have no representative of South Sudanese diaspora proper. And so our role as people in diaspora has been really to kind of be the voice for peace and call for peace and encourage people in South Sudan, whether they are people that you know, are on a horizontal level with us, like our colleagues, our friends, our family, or people in the seat of the government, representatives like MPs and, you know, various cabinet members. our role has been to voice our opposition against war and to make sure that protection of civilians is paramount, to make sure that they sit down and negotiate and bring about a solution that is first going to end war and second going to address all the issues that led to the explosion. And these issues, you know, would include, you know, creating institutions that respect the will of people and creating processes that are transparent so that losers don't just think that they were outwitted through unfair means. You know, when losers accept that they lost legitimately, or when they see that they lost legitimately, at least that would maintain peace. And so that the negotiation going on in Zimbabwe has, you know, have to kind of address those things. But the tension I see personally is that of justice and peace, because a lot of negotiations usually prioritize peace, right? They would want the war to stop, and then when people come back, there are provisions about not prosecuting this or not prosecuting that, or even if there are no such provisions, usually they would say that the state will go and address, you know, the justice issue. And when a government is formed that includes people who are complicit in the atrocities that have been meted out already, these people would not be interested in addressing the justice aspect of it. So whereas we are vocal and we are, you know, urging everybody, you know, people that we know and people that represent the interests of South Sudan to go for peace, we also make sure that they know that justice has to be done. And if it is not done, then at least, you know, a preventative aspect of what has happened has to be built into that peace. So as the diaspora group, we have no seat at the table, but our influence is very, very strong, mm-hmm. very strong in the sense that, you know, we are communicating and, you know, Facebook being what it is and Twitter being what it is and all those other things, those are the social media forum being that public. A lot of communications and public status update and all those things are seen by people, not just in diaspora, but also in South Sudan. And a lot of discussion goes on in some of these social media about what needs to be done. But there are those of us who are connected with people in the government or people outside the government, but also influential in different ways. And so those are the people, some people make contact with them if they're in the government and make sure that this is the sentiment. This is the sentiment. The sentiment is peace, but the sentiment is justice, but the sentiment is also addressing the root causes. And those of us here in Toronto and in Canada in general have gone to, you know, to kind of make our voices heard through public protest. Some people have gone to our house, some people have protested in various cities, including in Toronto here. And our community organization issued an official position that we shared with various media outlets when this explosion started. And so whatever is going on in Zimbabwe now, we'll see how it comes about. We'll see what the end result is. The end result, of course, is not going to meet every demand. But if it addresses what causes it, if it has some aspect built into it that will prevent a similar incident or any incident that is going to lead to more loss of life, then that would be the end goal. But at the end of the day, the two warring parties, the parties of conflict, that is the state represented by President Kiir and the rebellion represented by Dr. Riek Machar, mm-hmm. those parties have to, you know, to negotiate, not just for themselves, not just for them to come in power, not just for them to stay in power, not just for them to, you know, to not be prosecuted, but they have to negotiate, mindful that the presidency they both so aspire to be in is a public office, and an office that only exists because the citizens of South Sudan, you know, voted for a referendum and voted them into the office. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, they have to make sure that those civilians are not subjected to so much suffering. The suffering that they have been through for the past many years. So we will see what the end result is, but our role as a diaspora is really to motivate people, knowing that we have no official position at the table.
That brings us to the end of the time we have today for this interview. But Machar, I'd really like to thank you for joining us today and bringing us this very important perspective of the diaspora and also contextualizing the current situation in South Sudan. Of course, we also hope for a peaceful resolution at the mediation talks in Addis, and hopefully we'll be able to connect with you again sometime to continue this conversation.
Thank you very much, Anna, for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I and many people in Sudan descent and friends of South Sudan in diaspora pray for peace in South Sudan.
Amen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was, that was Machar, who was born in South Sudan and has been living in Canada for over a decade, and he is the chairperson of the South Sudanese community here in the GTA.